the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Spack. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, four Alaskan servicemen who have served in Afghanistan share their insights on their overseas duties, speaking on Operation Enduring Freedom. Colonel Edward Daly, who served as moderator of the panel, enlisted into the Army at age 17 in 1974. Deployed to Afghanistan for the first time in 2003, he returned to the United States from Afghanistan in 2004 as the director of the U.S. Central Command Office in Washington, D.C. From July 2005 until May 2007, Colonel Daly commanded the 187th Infantry Brigade at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. He was then assigned back to Afghanistan as the commander of ARSIC North Task Force Phoenix until July 2008. Colonel Daly is currently serving as the deputy commander of the U.S. Army in Alaska. His awards and decorations include the Legion of Merit, the Soldier's Medal, two Bronze Stars, and the Purple Heart, just to name a few. Recorded on Friday, April 3rd in Anchorage, Colonel Daly provided an overview of Operation Enduring Freedom with a slideshow before the three other panel members joined him in responding to questions from the audience. You can view the collection of photos Colonel Daly presented on our website, KSKA.org. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents Colonel Edward Daly.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. General Atkins, Colonel retired Mr. Finkel, Lisa Fausco, the executive director, students, guests, fellow warriors, Air Force, thank you very much for the opportunity. I speak on behalf of all of us here to have our chance to talk to you all today. Ladies and gentlemen, it's our intent at first. I will give a briefing. I'm going to talk a little bit about Afghanistan. I will talk about working with the Army. I'll talk about working with the police. I'll talk about working with coalition forces. I'll show a little bit about humanitarian assistance as well as the people. And then at the end, that is when we're going to open up for questions. If you have the opportunity, I direct your picture to the front there. That's a picture that I took out just in the northern part of Afghanistan of a shepherd in the middle of a snowstorm. If you look pretty close, not only is he smiling, those are sheep covered in snow and ice walking behind him on the side of a mountain. It's a, you know, about the many pictures I've taken in Afghanistan, that one picture just kind of embodies much of what I saw in Afghanistan working with the people, very hardy people, hardworking. And I hope at the end of this opportunity that you get an appreciation for not just what is the United States doing over there, but more importantly, what as much about Afghanistan that we can share with you. I truly have a passion for going over there. I shared with others that if I was asked tomorrow to go back to Afghanistan for a second tour, I would kiss my wife goodnight, and I'd go tomorrow. The significance also about that picture there is, you know, life is just hard in Afghanistan. And I was going to tell you that. And I remember a while back when I was, a long, long time ago, I was made Eagle Scout, and I sat back, and I was talking to my scoutmaster. Hey, I have hit that plateau. You know, I can sit back now. I'm now the consultant, you know. And he told me, he goes, Eddie, to whom much is given, much is expected. And I kind of like, what are you talking about? He said, to whom much is given, much is expected. Well, you know, we have a lot of blessings in this great country, the United States, and there's much that's happening over in Afghanistan. In this short period of time right in here, I hope that somehow you get a feeling for the myriad of things that are going on there from what I think is a country that has much to give to those that don't. Again, I am the Deputy Commander of the United States Army, Alaska. The actual commander, General Layfield, has also served in Afghanistan. He would love to have been here if he could. He is also a great speaker, and we appreciate the opportunity to get on here and talk to you all about this. A little bit about Afghanistan, if I may. You know, Afghanistan is not much in the news, but what about it I'd like to show you, of course, is Iran to the left, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan. People don't realize that China actually borders up in the Badakhshan region, which is an area that's probably not seen much of anything in the last 1,000 years of any kind of power or all that kind of things. And then, of course, we're very familiar with the Pakistani border right in here. You've heard of, let me highlight some particular areas for you. You heard of the Battle of Tora Bora, which happened kind of like in the beginning, right after the Battle of the Northern Alliance, up in the Mezar Sharif area up in here. Battle of Northern Alliance has kind of like brought an end to the Taliban. But the insurgents, the terrorists, they were coming across Pakistan. They're in this area, Tora Bora. Sergeant Major Megan, Master Sergeant Anderson, and of course the Second Lieutenant himself. They worked a lot in this area right in here. This is the East region along that you hear a lot of the discussions today about cross-border and whatnot. Here's Kandahar, very interesting city. Kandahar comes from Alexander, by the way. Alexander was in this region, 320 B.C., and that they named that town after him. So a lot of the British influence that you hear about is in this particular area right in here, and I expect Sergeant Major Megan and Master Sergeant Anderson to talk about that, though I have been down there myself, up in Terrancout area. But this region is where you hear a lot of fighting going along the border region. However, there's others going on in most of this country. So I just kind of want to orient you about the country itself. In Afghanistan, these are the major ethnic groups. We do not have time in this hour here for me to tell you how they all came about. But that's a district map, not a province map, of the major tribal influences in that region. And I want to make you aware that if you think along nationalism, in other words, we're trying to make Afghanistan a country, in the background, there is very strong tribal beliefs and where they came from. For example, Hazara comes from Genghis Khan, who was there in 1200s. Hazara means 1,000. When Genghis Khan worked his way across, he would drop off communities of 1,000. Those communities are still out there to this day. And then you've heard, you know, the Pashtun region, which I'll show you here in this next slide. You know, to an Afghan, they don't see boundaries like you and I see boundaries, generally speaking. Those same regions now superimposed across what we consider the boundaries of this country. You can see where some of that concerns and issues come along. So for the government of Afghanistan, for the Western powers that are working with Afghanistan, sometimes they lose sight of the fact that many Afghans don't necessarily see the borders the way we do. However, there is nationalism that's trying to, hey, look, we are one Afghanistan, proud of where you came from, but that's what it looks like. So that was kind of, just give you an idea what the background looks like as you look at Afghanistan. Afghanistan has been broken up into about 30 different provinces. Each of these provinces has a governor, elected governor, now in just about every case. I think it is, so I'm not exactly sure on that, but I know that many of them are elected, certainly up in the north and eastern regions. And when the war happened in 2001 and the Western powers got together, you know, how are we going to take care of this country, Afghanistan? What are the different lead nations going to do to bring stability in this? The United States took on the responsibility of being the lead nation for training and equipping and preparing the army. Germany took on the responsibility of police forces. I'm going to talk about that in a second. And Italy took on the responsibility of legal. So with that triad, these different nations went about their business of setting, you know, how are we going to get this country prepared. More of that will follow because I'm going to show you what happened, particularly with the police in that. But those countries in 2002 said, okay, that's our mandate, that's our main focus, we'll go and do that. Also, there was other issues to start putting lines of communication stability into the country. In particular, radio antennas so that you can work cell phones, and there's no road infrastructure in this country. So a major international effort went about to put in a thing called the Ring Road. You know, a road that literally would go around Afghanistan so that we could start connecting the different major areas together so we can, you know, have commerce going and people going back and forth, etc. So at a cost of approximately $1 million a mile, headed by the Chinese principally, with a lot of Afghan work, the country was put together. I'm going to show you some of that in a second. First, I'm going to talk about the country, then I'll talk about the road. Contrary to popular belief, Afghanistan is not all one big desert. This picture was taken up in the north. As you can see in the springtime, this particular time in Afghanistan, it's a growing season. That's where you'll see a lot of the migration going on with Bedouin-type tribes because they're moving their herds across. They're getting the grasses and all that kinds of things. So you'll see grasses growing. You'll see wheat. In my particular area in the north, the second tour, cotton was a major export where it was grown, which is a lot of areas up there. You can see here some of the fields that are growing up in the northern particular regions because there's water this time of the year. However, it will dry out quickly, as you can see here in October. This picture is taken in October time frame. Certainly after June, there's no more water to be talked to really speak about in this country, and it's a barren, dry land, so the growing is done there. There's many mountains in the north as well as down along the eastern edge, snow almost all the time year long, as you'll see there. And this is a picture of a typical Afghan village. There is big, large cities, but the smaller cities and smaller towns that a lot of us have experience with are literally mud hut walls, mud hut buildings surrounded by mud hut fences, which you'll see, approximately 2 to 3 feet thick. Could have been there hundreds, if not thousands, of years, as I've been told. But that's what the people live in. If you notice, that's a dry river in the front of that, in this one particular town. But that's the kind of villages that people live in for most provinces in Afghanistan. This is a winter picture taken not too far from Bagram Airfield, as a matter of fact. That shows you, of course, you see the snow. People are surprised that there's snow in Afghanistan. There's a lot of snow in Afghanistan, certainly in the northern portions. But there is a village inside that walled village, inside that mud wall behind that picture, just to give you an idea of some of the bleak barrenness in some of these areas. I talked about the Ring Road. The Ring Road was an effort, again, to connect major parts of Afghanistan together. It's literally drew a circle around there, started carving, putting road work on there, et cetera. You can see in this particular picture, there's lots of commerce, the trucks, big-time trucks around that. Next slide here, this is a U.S. convoy, which is how we will normally travel across Afghanistan, an up-armored Humvee. If you look behind in the back there, there's a motorcycle. You can't see it very well, but there's a man in the front with two females on the back of that motorcycle. There's another gentleman walking on the side of the road right there, because that's the only road around town. It is not paved in all areas. It's paved in some. I'll show you some of those pictures, but generally speaking, it's a dirt road. In time, about the next 3 years, I understand, it certainly should be all paved, but it's moving along rather slowly. Here's a picture going up a steep embankment. Again, I told you, they just wherever the line was drawn, they built the road. In the far distance, you can see radio towers are starting to go around the country. You can almost talk in almost all areas in Afghanistan on cell phone. And that's a product since the war in 2001. Here's a picture taken of a paved area. That's a 180-degree turn of the Ring Road. This road was actually built by the Russians when they came. This is up the Salong Tunnel area. That is literally a cliff off the side of that road there, just to show you how steep some of these regions can be. That's a picture taken in the wintertime. So there is some progress being made. It's not everywhere. Most roads are dirt. But the national effort's been on this Ring Road to connect most of Afghanistan together. Main mission for most soldiers over in Afghanistan today is to work with the Afghan army and the police. Especially now recently, Gentleman Kiernan, you hear him talking about efforts to bring stability into the region. I told you that the United States Army worked with our mission at first was to build up the army, the Afghan National Army. So since 2002 until like right now, 2009, that's 7 years that the United States has been putting a lot of effort into the Army. So first, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Army. This is a picture of some Army soldiers. If you look close, you'll notice that that's Soviet helmets, Soviet weapons. There's an AK, Soviet RPG. The truck is a Ford truck that was purchased, worked out somehow through the United States government for them on them. This is their uniforms, of course, our old BDU-type uniforms. It's a very, very proud army, with the soldiers. He's not some kind of terrorist right there you see running around with a baklava on his head, excuse me, and covering up. It's just a matter that they want to, you know, stay out of the dust like you see this soldier right here. The army soldier there gets about $100 a month. Wherever the army goes, generally stability follows. The national effort is to make sure that they have ethnic balancing, most of those ethnic groups in the army. For example, in the north, all corps, but in the north, they would actually report back, hey, we have so many Pashtuns, we have so many Hazars, we have so many Uzbeks. In the south, in the Kandahar area, they did not have that same number. They would move those tribes around to get ethnic balancing in the army. I show you this picture right here because my experience with the Afghan army has been they're very, very proud. They take care of their equipment. They love being soldiers, as you can see expressed in this group right here. Whenever we did any kind of operations, this is one of our Humvee vehicles right there. We always did operations with the Army, most of the time also with the police. You see heroes in the village going to a particular area. There are also U.S. soldiers on the ground, but in this particular picture, there are Afghan soldiers right there. The police is different. This is a picture of a police team located up in the northern part of Afghanistan. Right off the bat, you can see that the uniform's a little bit shabby. I'll use Master Sergeant Megan Sergeant Major Megan and Master Sergeant Anderson for examples. Master Sergeant Anderson was an Army MP. He worked over there with police forces. Then Master Sergeant Megan, of course, he's an infantry guy just like myself. In 2007, a decision was made. Hey, look it. We're not getting anywhere with the police. I'll be honest with you in the room right here. Germany's put up a police academy. It takes 3 years to make an Afghan policeman. After 3 years, you had one cop. One cop is not going to take care of the problem. We needed a system. In Afghanistan, we do ethnic balancing with the soldiers. It's different with the police. The police come from those districts. The police are literally, ladies and gentlemen, the tip of the spear. No matter how much you're doing with the rest of the country, the bad influences, the terrorists, the trouble will target the police. They'll take down a police building that has two or three cops in it, and then they basically, you know, wreck the security in that particular region there. So in 2007, the decision was made, okay, those people that are coming over, we are now going to, you may have thought you were going to be training infantrymen, no longer now, you're going to be training police forces. When you come over here, what we want you to do is with the basics. We're going to start with equipment accountability. We're going to start with accountability of the people. We're going to look into this pay problems. We're going to look into all these particular issues so we can start shoring up the police problem and start building regional security. As I stand here right now, ladies and gentlemen, that's still probably the main issue that's going on in Afghanistan that people have to realize is, you know, we are building a great, strong army over there. When I first got there, my first tour, we had Afghan companies. When I left, we had Afghan corps. But the police now, that's been the focus, particularly in the last year with Major General Cohn and with General McKiernan now. More about the police, you see right here. Here's some police on our vehicle here. These particular police, you notice their communication is still cell phone. They get two uniforms a year. That's the summer uniform. The winter uniform is wool. Again, they're a local area. They come from a local area, whatnot. People ask, well, what about corruption? All those kinds of things. I could talk about that. You know, we decided, we being the United States Army and the different programs, that we would go to a particular district, take all the policemen out of that district, send them to academy as one big group, teach them what's right and wrong, teach about jurisdiction, talk about law, how to handle people and everything. But when you put them back into that town, that issue, that wherever that corruption was, that's still out there. Those influences are still out there. So how do we go about that problem? Well, the answer is we're going to do two things. One is called pay parity, which means we're going to work with the Afghans so that a policeman will make about $100 a month, just like a soldier will. Right now, that normal police officer will make about $28 a month. And Sergeant Major, am I about right on that cost? I make about $25, $28 a month. The other thing is EFT, electronic fund transfer. We're going to cut out the middleman. First off, they didn't have a banking system. That's since gotten better. We're going to make sure that their pay goes straight to the bank instead of from me to Sergeant Major to the sergeant to the police person down in line there. Everybody along the way, they're kind of cutting some of that funding down there. So that's been going on, but efforts have been going about to fix that, especially over the last year. So the individual policeman, in many cases, not all, now does see light at the end of the tunnel. It's all part of the stability of the entire region of, you know, what are we doing to, you know, bring goodness into this system and get rid of the old corruption. We're not there yet, but we certainly have made great progress where it's going at, but we're not there yet. There's many, many provinces in Afghanistan, and of course, you know, when soldiers come over there, you'll take a whole team and put it in one province. There may be 9 or 10 provinces, correctly, 9 or 10 districts in a province, and of course, there's 30 provinces. So you can see how big the problem is going on, and you can see why it's going to take a while. The focus is on, you want stability, it's on the police. The army shows up, problems generally go away because the army's in there, et cetera. But stability lies with the police. And if you have more questions about later on, I'd be glad to talk about that. This is a normal police truck. This is all they have, and they move around on their vehicles. Just showing them going down the road right there, as you see like that. Another part of the issue over in Afghanistan is working with coalition forces. This is a German helicopter. Not all of Afghanistan is covered by American helicopters or American medevacs. Matter of fact, generally speaking, the central and eastern regions are the only areas where you'll see that. In the south, in Kandahar, you'll see U.S., again, mostly British. In the north, where this picture is taken, it's heavy German influence. And out in the west, it's Italian and Spanish influence. So what's the role of coalition forces? Generally speaking, their job is to coach, teach, and mentor. To, like in this particular case right here in this picture, they will get with the Afghans, show them how to do military decision making. They'll show them how to run ranges. They will show them how to operate their vehicles and work radios, etc. The question comes up is, are they involved in combat operations? Well, Not necessarily. First off, this is a picture of a German convoy. The medical assets moving out. We're going to set up a forward operating base in the northern part of Afghanistan in this particular picture. They brought the medical assets. They brought their helicopters. They are by various different NATO agreements. They're limited by the range of their doctors and their medical helicopters. So the reach out in the far regions where myself and Sergeant Major Meegan will go out with our teams, we, the U.S., will go with the Afghans, we'll go anywhere we want because, to be honest with you, we are on an OEF mandate. They are on a different mandate, part of the ISAF mandate, International Stabilization Afghanistan Forces. That's there's a little bit different, so they don't exactly go everywhere that we go. You'll see here in the picture, here's some Germans putting up a communication unit. But when Coxwell Combat Operations came along, you know, that came down to literally U.S. and Afghan forces. And down in the south where Master Sergeant Anderson and Sergeant Major Meegan were, of course, was the British and Canadian. I don't have any pictures of that, but they're much more involved. But in the north, right up in here, it would generally be a direct combat operation like this. It would be the U.S. and Afghans. Other forces would be involved at times, but a planned operation, as you see right in here, that would be us. In this picture right here, you'll see the Afghans leadership right here on the right. You will see an interpreter standing right there. You'll see U.S. forces right here. On the ground, you'll see some boxes and some lines. We're getting ready to go make a raid in a particular area in northern Afghanistan. So this is a leader huddle just before we go into combat operations. I'm not going to go into many pictures about combat operations, certainly not the gory stuff, but I just wanted to let you show you this. You know, this is an operation getting ready to happen. The next morning when we came back, this is a very interesting picture, and I hope you get to see some things in there I want to point out. First off, inside that pit, which you do not see for a lot of reasons, is the prisoners that we brought back on this particular raid that, by the way, came from countries outside of Afghanistan. Those are Afghan soldiers in that pit. That's an Afghan medical soldier, and if you look very close in his left hand, you can see a bandage. Yes, that's blood. He's working on an Afghan prisoner that was wounded. Right there, one, two, three are three American mentors, coaches, trainers that are medical advisors overseeing, making sure they're doing everything right. They're not involved in this thing. This is an Afghan issue. There's an interpreter standing right there. And in the background, you see two German soldiers. This happened near a forward operating base that the Germans were at. They were not involved in the combat operation. They came over to see what was going on. What's important about this picture is, first off, we documented the handling of all of this in case there was any issues, like what happened when the prisoners came back. There was no issue that came about that. Afghans captured them. Afghans turned them over to their legal authorities, et cetera. So I documented that just in case anything would happen. But I think it's important for the people in the room here to know that this operation literally was Afghan run and Afghan organized and right to the very end. I mean, that's the Afghans working with the Afghans. Yes, you know, there's U.S. oversight there, you know, but it's important for you to see that. It's not like we're running it. Oh, by the way, here, take this guy here, you do this, et cetera. There's much of that went on there, certainly up in the north and where I was at, as well as the rest of Afghanistan. I do want to highlight a couple of things about combat operations here. First off is that last year was the first time that Afghanistan, in the many different combat operations that it does, was the first time that Afghanistan did its own completely all-Afghan combat air assault mission. In other words, it is common for us to put Afghans on our helicopters, go somewhere, go into an objective. Not in this case right here. In May of 2008 last year, Afghan helicopters, Afghan soldiers, U.S. were involved. I was there, so were several others. I went on the Afghans when they went and did three air assault operations using all Afghan helicopters. A major move forward, because that was a former Soviet helicopter. Of course, the Afghans have gotten it. They refurbished it. They trained their pilots. And you see that this helicopter, when it landed in here, is Afghan soldiers getting out. I actually took this picture here. This is the first lift coming in. This is a picture, another one here. You can see some American soldiers right in here. The Afghans had just moved forward a little bit of us right in there. And you can see another helicopter load coming in. And then, of course, some of you may recognize a Hind helicopter. Soviet era, left behind when the Soviets left. That was our air support. I will not kid you, we had some communications problems on the humorous side when I was with the Afghan colonel, which you'll see here in a second, working this operation. It's like, how do we coordinate fire controls? And the answer was, watch where we land, follow the tracers out, don't follow the tracers in, you know. And it worked. It's comical, it worked, we're getting there, but it was a major effort. It was televised in Afghan televisions, et cetera. It was a big to-do. But I'm kind of proud of this event because you know, I saw it go from literally the beginning to the end. It was started off as, hey, look, you're on your own, trying to make something happen. The Afghan general got a hold of his Ministry of Defense and said, hey, look, if I get two helicopters, I think I can do more. And they scrounged up two helicopters as well as two attack helicopters. I was so proud of the Afghan general I was working with this thing because he was just going about getting on with this business. And I'll be honest with you, the ISAF German one-star that were working in this area was concerned and worried what was going to happen. And this operation was literally going so fast that the Afghan general was like, here's what I'm going to do next. This is what's going to happen. We're going here. And everybody was catching up to him. It was a great operation because things were moving fast, quick, organized, and there was an Afghan general in charge of it. This picture you see right here, this is once we landed. This is an American SATCOM antenna, satellite communication. That's mine to keep in contact with people. That's the Afghan colonel that's in charge of this operation. That's his radio right there. And this is an American advisor coach, teach, mentor that's working with him on that. But I just want to let you know that man is the guy in charge on the ground. And we were there, of course, but it was just a great operation to be associated with him, involved in that. Of course, every picture, I can't leave out the American soldier, the men and women, all services that whenever we did, they interact the most with the people. You can always find a GI. And literally, I'll be honest with you, General Atkins, there was different rules over there on how I took the Air Force out, but I would just change the mission to, you know, instead of being a combat mission, I had many humanitarian missions. I got the Air Force out there with me because I have a lot of Air Force medical personnel. They were a great help over there. And I'm sorry, I would have changed the picture if I knew there was somebody Air Force in here to show you the same thing. But they got out there, went around with the people all the time, and it was a great, great great to see the interaction with the people and the soldiers. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of that going on that you may or may not be aware of. I want to talk a little bit now about humanitarian assistance. We're not just doing all guns. We also do roses, guns and roses. That's a picture right there of a boy getting water. You take a look at that water, they're going to drink that water. They're going to wash with that water. They're going to do everything with that water. If you take a look now in the same picture off here to the left, there's a well being built right there. That well is being built by U.S. dollars called SERP, Commander's Emergency Relief Projects. There's millions of U.S. dollars involved in these many, many programs. How do we go about picking where that goes? How do you just decide, I'm going to go to this town and put a well in here? Well, the answer is we don't pick that. The Afghans do. We will go, like I have a general in charge in the north, there's a general in charge in the south and whatnot. In order to get stability in that region, he will talk with the tribal leaders, he will talk with the provisional governors, he'll talk with all these people, and they'll say, hey, look, we need a water well in our town. We need a school. We need a building. We need an aid station. They need all these kinds of things. And his answer was, okay, you know, part of his strategic information, his strategic campaign, he would say, okay, Eddie, Army, go put a water well in this town. So we'd put that water well in there, and then they'd come by and they'd say, well, we want the next thing. And he'd say, well, you know, when I put that water well in, somebody came along and they destroyed it. You know, I need your help with the security. This other town, when I put the water well in, you know, the people kept it there. It's running fine. So why should I put another well in your town? All of a sudden, people get it. You want this stuff, you know, you've got to help be part of the defending and protecting it and make it work. And that's how that is picked. And in areas where it's going well, you know, more happens. When there's areas where there's trouble and violence, we say, hey, look, you got to be part of the fix of this so that people get involved and more of those monies flow in there. That's a simplified version of it, but that's happening across the length and breadth of Afghanistan. And there's much of that that's being done that I don't have the total numbers for, but I just wanted to give you an idea that that's happening across Afghanistan. There's other humanitarian assistance operations. We work with the United Nations as well as the ISAF NATO forces. This is a picture taken in the wintertime. If you look real close there, you'll see that mud wall of the village right there. You see a small little mud wall. Someone has a little tent. People live in that. In the wintertime in the north where I was at, you know, snow comes, people are desolate. I mean, they're out there on their own. And there's very little shoes, clothing, food, all this kind of stuff. So the United Nations, ISAF, the U.S. coalition forces, we will bring, again, working with the general, where does this stuff need to go? We'll start taking it out to people. This is a picture taken of some children in one particular area. If you look close at their hands, you'll see frostbite on their hands right there. This particular village, not only did it need help, as you notice, take a look at their shoes. There is no rubber shoes or mukluks we see here in the great state of Alaska. That's all they have right there. Ladies and gentlemen, harden your hearts with this next picture. There's a lot of that in Afghanistan. And I debated about if I should even show this picture, but I think it's important to let everyone know that, you know, there is a great need for help. And I'm not here trying to say go donate that kind of help there, but this is what we do a lot of over in Afghanistan. You know, not to disturb people in there, but I want to bring this to your attention there in this particular village. You know, these children lined up to get help. I brought in Swedish doctors from the north. They stayed there until sunset. Harden your hearts, ladies and gentlemen, at around 1900, 7 o'clock at night. They said it was time to go. People wanted them to stay. They said, no, we got to go back to Mezar Sharif. Parents took axes. They took shovels. They started chopping off limbs on their kids because they needed the medical help. Okay, once they saw it happening, people stopped. Okay, let's get on with this. I'm not trying to give you a something horrific to remember here, but I want to realize that there's so much that's going on and that we're involved in that just as much as we are in getting rid of the enemy over there. And I want you to just kind of be aware of that. I'd be more than glad to talk more about that afterwards here. But on a happy note, if you take a look at this picture here, this is a particular picture of a relief column going out to the middle of nowhere to help people that are literally dying for help. This picture was taken as they drove off through a snowstorm, which was before desert. Now it's all covered in snow. In the front, that's a Norwegian medical group and provisional reconstruction team personnel, PRT. That's a police vehicle. That is a humanitarian assistance truck full of supplies. That's another police vehicle. And at the very end of that, it's a U.S. vehicle, police or a Army mentor team following out behind as they go somewhere. Again, General Wars has helped me to go. In my particular area in the north, I had up to 900 people freeze to death. In the west, my friend had approximately 1,400 that froze to death. I just wanted to give you an idea when we talk about Afghanistan that this is not just about people fighting along the border. Again, it kind of heartens back to my scoutmaster, too much is given, much is expected. This is a picture taken of school aid coming to different children. We get tons of this stuff from many people, different schools. And we go out to the many, many, many schools. If you take a look here, this is a end of a hallway. In other words, there's rooms to the left and the right. They took a sheet, they put it into the hallway. So these are boys on this end. They had girls at the other, and they're handing out crayons right in here. So this is one of the many pictures. This is from a grade school in Niskayuna, New York, that sent us some stuff, and we went out there and distributed it, you know, to one of the local schools, one of hundreds. They all need it. I'm going to close now with some pictures of the people. I'm going to some questions. I could go forever about it, but just give you an idea. Travel by donkey is very, very common. There's a gentleman doing that. It's very common to see young girls, 8 to 10, being the one that's carrying the babies around all the time. You'll see that. It's not common to see the adult women. It's very rare, actually, to see girls out often like that. But after a while, they'll come out. But it's very common to see that. Most of the country's shepherds, here's a boy with his shepherd flock, he'll be gone all day long into the night. You'll see that throughout the country. Of course, I saw the National Geographic picture of the girl with the eyes, and you know, I was kind of taken aback in Afghanistan. You see that quite a lot. Literally a beautiful people and a wonderful country on that. But again, a girl out there with some young child. There's some more girls that were coming up there. It's not all rags. I mean, you'd be surprised. You'd be in the middle of nowhere. And they dress up. They come out. They want to see what's going on there. Just two little girls out in the area, curious to see what we're up to. This is a place called Jarisia out in the far west. At the time, a very heavy Taliban area. When we went out there, we started giving out stuff. And then first the boys show up, and eventually the girls came out. There's a picture of the girls that came out to the region. There's no water in that town. You can take a look at that picture, and you can see that that's exactly an issue. When we left, we made arrangements to put a well in that area. And so when I left the country in May, we were going back there to put a second well into that region. It's very common to see women wearing burqas. My wife asked me, why do they wear those burqas? And I told her, I honestly think to stay clean. But as far as their custom, blue used to mean that it was a married woman, and white meant that it was, you know, a young girl that's changed over to a woman. But that's very common to see traveling around in a burqa like that. It's a very rare picture. Girls don't normally come out, but they came up. We were stopped by a door one time. They came out. They're all stuff was we're giving out sandals in this particular case. They came on out there. It was a big social gathering. It turned out to be a good event. And I just took a picture over there of some of the people. It's very common. If you look close to this gentleman, he has no shoes. I have no idea what he was doing. He came walking up to us one day, you know, working on something with the mud, but it's just a particular picture of Afghanistan, of a guy coming up to us. Many, many times you see these are boys, American soldiers, a camera right over here on the bottom of the picture there. They took his picture on a digital camera, and everybody wanted to have to see what their picture looked like. Take my picture, and they wanted to see what it looked like. They, in this particular town, they never saw a picture before. Again, the interaction with the people. I could spend all day talking about that. Imagine if we're in Parks Highway, going up to Alaska, and I have like three more pictures left, and your truck breaks down. You call AAA in Afghanistan, you fix it yourself. You look real close, there's the axle, there's the rings, there's the tires, there's a log holding it up, there's the Army soldier waiting for the supplies to come by. That's Afghanistan. You want to go to the restaurant? What's for chow? We're going to have goat. There it is. There's the goat, and there's the restaurant. We're getting ready to have shish kebab. Just interesting pictures. There's a picture that I took, it's cold night, let's go warm up the vehicle. But this is a technique, I wouldn't recommend it. If you look close, it's got a fire up on there. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to open up to, I could talk all day long with Afghanistan here. This is a picture of a sniper in the ground, and I open it up now. Do you have any particular questions for myself or the panel that I have here? But again, on behalf of all of us here, I appreciate the opportunity to share even a small matter of this with this country, and I hope at the end of it all, you know, my voice may sound low, but my passion is high for Afghanistan, and I'd go there tomorrow. They're wonderful people. With that, ladies and gentlemen, do I have any questions?
You've been listening to Colonel Edward Daly speaking on Operation Enduring Freedom, recorded on April 4th in Anchorage. You can view his photos from Afghanistan on our website. It's kska.org. Colonel Daly recently returned from serving in Afghanistan along with Sergeant Major Patrick Meegan, Master Sergeant Scott Anderson, and Second Lieutenant John Romspert. Before responding to questions from the audience, Colonel Daly, who served as the moderator, asked the three other members of the panel to introduce themselves.
Before going any further, I'll just ask if the microphone will work. If you just briefly introduce yourself, Lieutenant, work your way down to the Command Sergeant Major. Just tell us who you are, just a little bit about yourself.
Hello, I'm 2nd Lieutenant John Romspert, Combat Rescue Officer with the 2TEL Rescue Squadron, Coolis Air National Guard. I've been to Afghanistan twice. I am responsible for all the logistics for the unit, and welcome to be here. Thank you.
I'm Master Sergeant Anderson. I am currently serving as the Command Sergeant Major for the Arctic Military Police Battalion here in Alaska. I've got two combat tours of Afghanistan, where I served as an Operations Sergeant in military police companies, and in 2004 and in 2006.
Good afternoon. I'm Command Sergeant Major Patrick Meegan. I'm the Sergeant Major of the 1st Battalion, 297th Recon and Surveillance Cavalry Squadron. I served in Afghanistan from 2005 through 2008, and actually, I know Sergeant Anderson, and I worked for Colonel Daly, so thank you.
After introducing themselves, the servicemen responded to questions from the audience. First, an audience member said he recently met a man in the United States who had emigrated from Afghanistan. According to the Afghan immigrant, most of the violence in Afghanistan was from outside coming in. He asked the servicemen, is this true?
I'm going to ask Sergeant Major Meegan. Sergeant Major, I'm going to pass the microphone to you. You were down on the border more than I was. We'll start with you. He's talking about outside area influences into the district.
Well, historically, you have all the different tribes, and being a tribal nation, there's going to be conflict between the tribes. Since 2001, a lot of the incidents are from foreign fighters and people coming across the border from Iran or Pakistan or wherever they may happen to come across. It's an open border. It's not like the United States. They do have border police, but we're talking a very large country, very remote, and anybody can come across, and it's not like they have visa control or anything like that. So, it's tough to stem that tide, and there is a lot of it. Talking about that, I'm actually in the process of trying to bring three of my interpreters over to the United States. So, I had to tell them, you're coming to Alaska. Any of the Afghans will tell you that. It's a lot of the trouble is from outside. You know, the Afghan are extremely, extremely proud people. They love Afghanistan. And they love that the Americans are there to help them. And you can see it in their face every day. So.
Next, another audience member asked if most people in Afghanistan are still nomadic. If so, could this somehow contribute to the current problems, such as people freezing to death?
Okay, ma'am, I cannot speak about if they're nomadic or whatnot. I agree completely with Command Sergeant Major. Those people are in that area because that's their roots. It has been there for a very, very, very long time. The people that I'm not familiar with that live there, a snowstorm would come, you know, they have nothing in the regards of there's no wood to burn, so they burn tires. They'll be in that house. So when there's deaths in this particular case, it's carbon monoxide poisoning, it's freezing, it's all of those things put together in that. But there's, to be honest with you, there's really not, when there's nowhere else to go. That is their home. That is where they live that in. And I'd like to add on what the Sergeant Major said. They're extremely proud of where they're at, what they're doing, and all that. When the Taliban were there, what little bit I know about, yes, they did go to Pakistan to get away from all of that, but they came. When that problem went away, they came back to those home regions. So the few nomadics that I saw, the mad people, Bedouin types that I saw, they were the rare case, not the normal case.
It has been reported by various media outlets that the president of Afghanistan's sphere of influence does not extend beyond the city, another audience member stated. Is this true?
Again, you have to remember that it's a very remote country. Until the Ring Road was built, it was very hard to even know who was in power. I can tell you for five instances right off the top of my head in the mountains, I'd go up with the Afghan army. And people would come up and try to speak Russian to me because they thought I was Russian. They didn't know there was a central government in Kabul. So it depends on really where you're at. As far as does his sphere of influence extend past there, I know it does. I can speak from just from talking to all the different people. I've gone into many villages in all different parts of Afghanistan, and they know who President Karzai is, and they're always asking for help from the central government. And plus, that's the Afghan army. That's who they are. They're the central government. So, you know, their job is to extend that sphere of influence. And then the police for the local area and the national police for the entire country.
Another audience member asked the servicemen to discuss the language challenges they encountered in Afghanistan.
The languages, there's at least two major languages. There's Pashtun and Dari. So we ran into problems with when we would move from Bagram in the Kabul area, which is central to north, down to the southern regions of Kandahar and Spin Bulduk, where Sergeant Major and I were at together on the Pakistan border. We ran into problems where we could not take our interpreters, and if any of my soldiers would learn Dari up in the north, we would go down to the south, it was almost like a completely different language. If on the outside, looking at any script like that, it's hard for us to tell if you don't really know what the letters and the alphabet looks like, but to them it's completely different. It would be like us looking at Russian or Chinese, so the languages are almost completely different.
If you don't mind, I just want to add to that. When I initially got to Afghanistan, I went down. I got some training in Dari, and Dari's like Farsi, close but not exactly. So I got some training in Dari, and I go to an area that speaks no Dari. My commander spoke Dari, but everybody else spoke Pashtun. You step outside the gate, everybody speaks Pashtun. And I was assigned to the French Special Forces, who only spoke French. Some language problems, you have to learn quick. Start with words, pick up the words, and then when they start saying sentences, I heard that word, that word, that word, I get the gist of what they're saying. Plus, you know, a lot of times you have your interpreter. But, you know, we're very fortunate, you know, to have those interpreters. I think I can vouch for pretty much anybody that has done that job over there, that the interpreters are a tool that we have, and it really helped. After you know, being in Afghanistan for a while, I really didn't need the interpreter anymore, but it was a challenge in the beginning. I would spit out a sentence that had Pashtun, Dari, and French in it.
Next, as President Obama requests an additional 10,000 troops be sent to Afghanistan, What do you anticipate their mission will be?
Okay, ma'am. First off, I cannot talk to what the 10,000 are doing. I'm not there right now. I can assume from my readings that they're engaged into, again, the stability. The stability that I understand the forces going in there is, you know, I won't call a surge, but in the summertime, you know, to be honest with you, you saw what the winter conditions were like. So in the wintertime, not much happens because, you know, they're doing all they can to survive. But in the summertime, more fighting happens during that time. So we're, my opinion, what I understand, we're going to get ahead of that bow wave and start being available to get to go towards those forces. Because, ma'am, this is an election year in Afghanistan again. And with stability brings the votes, and like it did in, off the top of my head, I think it was 2004. I was over there, but then we had the 2004 election. And people love to vote. They want to get out there. Men and women are out there trying to do that. So these forces, as I understand it, are going to be additional to help keep the stability out there for that. There's other agencies out there that are doing humanitarian assistance, not just the U.S. I mean, there's non-government organizations. They work underneath the auspices of the United Nations. The United Nations will work them on that. So, yes, we're involved in that but because it's in our area. We help set up the conditions for success and all that. Lieutenant, you had something you wanted to say, sir.
Yes, first I'll finish with you, ma'am. Also on the Air Force side, one of our biggest things we're going to do with this bolstering a troop is provide more rescue. The ability to take our helicopters and our fixed-wing assets and deploy to these remote areas and get medical attention where other coalition forces cannot get to either as quick or as capable with the assets that we can bring, both for American soldiers, ISAF soldiers, and the Afghani people. And then on your question, sir, as far as the interpreter and the language barrier, when the Air Force forces, unless we're working with a special forces detachment or assigned to another unit, we don't have interpreters. And our primary mission and rescue, when we fly out to these forward operating bases, we rescue Afghani people. We bring them back providing medical treatment in the back of a helicopter, usually at night. And they don't understand what I'm saying. I don't understand what they're saying. And you're trying to fix them. You know, and it gets to be a big game of charades almost. But, you know, we do our best of giving the best care that we can through the dark, in the night, trying to get them to, you know, a level of care that's going to do them some good.
There's also the issue of you have a child that's wounded, hurt, whatever the case is. You know, our culture is where's the mother or the father. So you could probably say more about this than I can, but here's the child. Where's the adult? We're going to take this child somewhere. And then, so we're not even sure you got the right adult in that, but that issue's out there as well.
Afghanistan is known for its poppy growth and heroin cultivation, another audience member stated. What is being done to change this?
Okay, I don't have a picture of poppies. I'll have to work on that. There is poppies in Afghanistan. There's hashish. There's that stuff in the country. I'll just tell you what little bit I know, sir, from my first tour when I worked with the planners on how we're going about stability in this region and then where it's going today. The United States' effort when I was doing this in 2003-2004 was we recognized the problem with poppies and hashish. But our main purpose is we're going to get stability in this region, and if we start going after that, we're going to create much more instability in an already unstable area. So our efforts have been to work on the Army, work on the police, work on the different provinces. We know where these drug areas are at and whatnot. We will get to them eventually. At that time, when I was working with the British, they had a different philosophy. And again, Britain has a different problem. Because much of the hash and the poppy traffic was going to Europe versus the United States. So I'm not trying to say either one was better or worse. I'm just saying their focus was more towards eradicating that poppy right then and there because that was a problem that they had right in front of them. So our Army efforts and our missions, I never had a mission to go out and get rid of poppies or hashish. I would see them in the course of the business. I would let people know where they're at, and it would be turned over to the government of Afghanistan. The government of Afghanistan does not support this. They're all about poppy eradication, to getting rid of the drugs. You know, they know that it's the root of many, many bad evils in there. But it's still a big problem in a lot of areas. In the north, governors would come to me to show that the major efforts that they did, I would go through many, many miles of northern Afghanistan and not see poppies I would see hashish, wouldn't see any poppies. When I got to the western regions, I did see some of it. But, you know, that they are going about getting rid of that. We're not there yet, sir. But for the audience here, I just wanted to understand, you know, if we go in there, what's the crop to replace that? I don't have that answer. There's those efforts that are going on there. It's a big problem. It's being worked at. Just understand those particular philosophies. I do not know the current U.S. policy towards it, but I do know the Afghans are definitely against it, and we'd tell them where it's at, and they'd go out, and et cetera. Is anything else you want to add about that? We're good to go?
I don't. Sir, I can tell you on my second tour when I was down in the same region with Sergeant Major Megan, my patrols, my military police patrols, we would not actively seek out poppy fields or drug houses. But if we happened to come upon something that was suspicious activity, that would be reported back to me. Unfortunately, I was one of those guys that we would call a fobbit. I didn't get out very much, so my experiences were kind of limited to listening to a radio and picturing and envisioning what was going on out there to the soldiers on the ground. But I was the guy having to make the decisions as to what they would do. And a lot of times they would come upon a house, and it was rather, unfortunately, I don't have a picture of it either. But there would be a little house out there in the middle of nowhere, and it's not a house like you expect. It's kind of like the Colonel showed, just a little mud hut. But the soldiers would see two tractors, and these tractors would be backed up to the front of the houses. But they'd have one wheel taken off, and they'd have basically a thumper wheel put onto it, so that as this wheel would go around, it would act as a lever, and it would push. There was like a 12 by 12 beam that would go into the house, and that's how they would take, because there's nothing sophisticated about a lot of the remote regions over there. So they would take these tractors, and they'd go outside, and they'd start up this tractor, and it would basically start this thumper, and they'd have a little pit inside, and they'd throw the raw poppies and hashish into this stuff, and that would be the masher. And the tractor would be the mechanism to do the mashing, and we would confiscate thousands of pounds of drugs and bring it back to our FOB, our forward operating base, where we would then either destroy it or we'd turn it over to the country. But while we were doing that, again, it wasn't our mandate to do, but we would take the effort to destroy the house and destroy the tractors, much to the chagrin of the locals, would then rocket attack us, you know, in thanks for eradicating. I don't believe it was the locals themselves, but the drug lords who, you know, we took a little bit of money out of their pocket. But that was some of the efforts we were doing over there.
Another audience member asked the servicemen if they think Afghanistan is still a secularized Muslim country. Or do you think Afghanistan has become more of a radical Muslim country since the start of the war?
Ma'am, I can't speak to secular Muslim, but I can tell you from personal experience that the Muslim religion, I'm not Muslim, the Muslim religion is a beautiful religion. I mean that sincerely. I had an Afghan general who was very Muslim. You know, he would say prayers before we would eat. He had his religious leader would talk to the soldiers. He would remind them about, you know, the religion and tied in with nationalism, with Afghanistan. The radical part, I'll be honest with you, man, I never saw that in 2 years there. I'm not going to say it's there. I'm going to ask Sergeant Major if he had any experience with that. You know, when I dealt with people that were radicals, they were just bad guys all the way around, to be honest with you. And it wasn't a particular religious sect. I know that's out there. I do know that there were people arrested. I've read the news. I don't know personally. Read the news in the Mezar Sharif area where someone would be, you know, putting out some kind of literature against President Karzai or about, you know, women, and he'd be put in jail. I've heard of those stories. But I my personal experience was those were the very, very few. Sergeant Major, anything you want to add or say anything about that? Please.
You know, I think that... You know, we have to understand a lot of times that every country has things that they do. We do stuff that every country questions that, you know, why do you do it this way? Why do you do it that way? I personally never really saw anything, you know, anybody get arrested for anything that wasn't a true violation of, you know, human law, you know, not just that country. Stealing, et cetera, you know. Was there killing? Of course it was killing, you know, two people fighting. A lot of the times, though, it was, you know, there were issues, and we have no control over individual issues. If it happened once, it happened. If it happened once and it didn't happen 99.9% of the time, you know, it's not a norm. there's a lot of stories out there that you're going to hear about this happened and that happened. You know, it's a story. I never, ever saw it myself, and I was there a considerable length of time. So.
The last member of the audience selected to address the servicemen asked, "What is the extent of the Taliban influence in Afghanistan? How successful have you been in combating the Taliban? And how long do you think American troops will remain in Afghanistan?"
Yeah, the Taliban influence is actually, when I initially got there in 2005 and I was in the Kandahar area, which is where the Taliban actually started, and it's still a stronghold today because that's historically, that's where they began, that's their roots. It has actually dropped back a lot, the actual Taliban portion of it, because we're pretty deep into the war. We've been over there since 2001, 2002, early 2002. A lot of that influence is gone. The influence is actually coming from the countries outside Afghanistan. A lot of places, you have the diehards, you have the holdouts, but they're in such small groups, it's really ridiculous. But you have to remember, we do have the media. Something happens with three people, and it's a big deal. Somebody gets shot, somebody gets killed, and it happens. When I initially got there, I would say I was running into bands of 300, 250, 300. And when I left, it was down to maybe 30, maybe 20. To me, that's a significant difference. And take my word for it, it is a significant difference.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents Colonel Edward Daly, Sergeant Major Patrick Meegan, Master Sergeant Scott Anderson, and Second Lieutenant John Romspert, four Alaskan servicemen who have served in Afghanistan. Recorded in Anchorage on April 4th, all four servicemen responded to questions from the audience following Colonel Daly's talk on Operation Enduring Freedom. You can view the photos Colonel Daly shared in the first half of the show on our website, kska.org. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show and share your comments with us and other listeners online at kska.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.